Welcome to the Faculty Podcast, brought to you by RTS Washington, part of a 50-plus year endeavor to train pastors and other leaders in the ministry of the gospel in the United States and around the world. We've got a special episode for us today, emphasizing the around-the-world aspect of our ministry environment. We have a special guest, Alex Tseng, with us, and I will let Gray introduce him and tell us a little bit about what we'll be talking about today.
Yeah, thanks so much for that, Tommy. Alex is a good friend of mine. He did his MDiv at Regent College, his THM at Princeton Seminary, and then his DPhil at Oxford University, writing on the theology of Karl Barth. He has written three monographs on Barth's theology, one for IVP on Barth's infralapsarian theology, the second of which is published by Routledge on Barth's theology of sin. And then the third one just came out, I think, last year, 2022, on Barth and Trinity and election, specifically, those two doctrines. So Alex is an expert in Barth theology, but not just Barth theology. He's also quite the unicorn, I always say, in that he's an expert in Barth theology, but also at the same time, very much an advocate for not only confessional reform theology in general, but also neo-Calvinism specifically. And if you know your history of theology, those two things don't usually go together. But we're very glad to welcome Alex here. Welcome, Alex, to our faculty podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. Perhaps we can start with this question, given that our listeners are probably interested in knowing more about who you are. Can you tell us a bit more about how you ended up within the Reformed tradition, how you became a Christian even, and your intellectual journey to this tradition?
Right. So I was born in Taiwan, and my parents are both Christians. Actually, I think I'm fourth generation Christian. So my great grandma was already a Christian. So I grew up in this Christian home, and I always prayed to God, always knew God. But when I was in college, I encountered some intellectual and personal crises. I was diagnosed with a kidney cyst, and the doctor said that it might be a malign tumor. So I wasn't worried, but then I started thinking about the problem of evil, the problem of suffering, like why do human beings suffer? So that was more of an intellectual problem for me. I was in my freshman year, physics, and the professors were all atheists, and they would challenge the Christian faith in the classroom. So I was met with those intellectual challenges, and I tried to overcome those challenges. So I went to the library, tried to pick up some philosophy books to try to solve those problems. They didn't really help me that much, but then through reading philosophers like Immanuel Kant, whom I didn't really understand at the time, I tried to come up with my own theological explanation for those problems. So I brought those answers to the Campus Crusade leader at UBC, University of British Columbia, at the time, Dan McDonald, who is now a PCA pastor in Toronto. And he told me that, well, those thoughts are pretty smart, but then somebody already came up with those theories, and those theories all were already deemed to be heretical. Those people were Arminians, and way before Arminians, someone named Pelagius. So he said, well, that's heresy. I need to show you what's right doctrine. So he took me to the seminary library, Regent College, actually, which was on the campus of UBC. So he took me there, and he showed me two volumes, and he told me to read them. I didn't know who the author was, but I just read the volumes, and I was really impressed. So I read it almost in one breath, and when I was reading it, I thought to myself that the God that this author is talking about is the God whom I've always known since my childhood. This is the God whom I've been praying to, except I didn't really understand him this way. And that author turned out to be John Calvin. The two volumes turned out to be the Institutes of the Christian Religion.
Of course.
And you know, it's one thing, however, to read Calvin, but another to pursue ministry. What led you to that decision? Well, specifically MDiv studies, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so When I was in college, there were many immigrants from China. They just flocked into the churches. Some of the local churches didn't even want them because they meant more ministry, more work and trouble. And they were intellectually very challenging to the pastors. So they just kept coming, and we just couldn't stop them. And when I saw people thirsting for the truth like that, I was deeply touched. And I thought, well, with my gifts, I might be able to do some things for them, for the cause of the gospel. So that was when I started contemplating the possibility of going into ministry. And at the time, I already felt that my calling was for missional ministry in China.
Mm. Yeah. And how did you end up deciding that the best way to do that is actually to pursue this very deeply academic route that you took up, not only going to do your MDiv and also your THM and also your DPhil afterwards?
I wasn't sure if I was going to go the academic route. I just felt that my calling was to be a missionary in China. I could be a pastor, or maybe I thought about becoming a musician, but then I didn't have the talent. So instead of becoming a musician, I could be a audio engineer. That was something that I was really interested in. But then I found out that I'm really bad with machines. So I didn't pursue that career. And when I was in seminary, I felt that academic theology was really something I enjoyed. I enjoyed writing the papers. I enjoyed reading all those big volumes. It also turned out that my undergrad major or second major was in German. Mm. I did German to to impress girls at the time.
Didn't we all go through that phase?
Yeah. There were other things you could have done, but you took the most noble path.
Well, I don't know, it didn't work.
You want to impress the ladies, you learn German. That makes sense to me.
That'll break them.
Yeah.
I should have taken Italian. It would have worked better. But I didn't. I don't know why German, but I took German. So in German major, we had to read original works by people like Nietzsche and Marx, not the deeper stuff like Hegel and Kant, but Marx, Freud, Nietzsche, those were people we had to read. So I had a little bit of philosophical background coming into seminary. So I felt that I was academically inclined. So I consulted my mentor, Jed Packer at the time. So I asked him, should I go down the academic route or should I not? Because my worry was that too much knowledge might make me proud, and pride is a bad thing. Packer told me, well, that's a problem you have to deal with yourself, but you are gifted with the talent to pursue academic theology, and if you don't use your talent, you'll have to think about how to answer to God. Wow. So that was what really prompted me to pursue a career in academic theology.
I can kind of envision J.I. Packer almost preaching that.
Yeah.
Fantastic. That's fantastic you even interact with J.I. Packer. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, that was a huge privilege.
Incredible. Yeah. I mean, he's just a giant in our
So. Yeah. But then in person, he is so down to earth and so humble.
Alex, your story is amazing. Your interest in and the publications on Bart, your pursuit into academic studies. You also shared your heart for China, and that's such a great aspect to have an academic so interested in the mission of the church and the sharing of the gospel. Your experience in China, you shared a little bit when we had dinner, is incredible. Can you share with us more? What is the current state right now of the church in China, and what's your heart and vision for that?
When I tell the China narrative, I like to emphasize God's grace instead of how Christians are suffering for Christ and how they're fighting for the cause of the gospel. My experience with churches in China, as well as my knowledge of the history of the churches in China, mostly underground churches, they haven't been always faithful to Christ, and they're often weak in the faith. But what has preserved them is really the grace of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. Theologically, the churches aren't very well equipped. And in terms of church governance, Asian churches tend to be very authoritarian. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to have any balance of powers in the churches. So the pastor will be like a big parent, and that would be justified by the excuse that the churches are under persecution. So if you want to protect the churches, you need strong leaders. Mm. So paternalism is very prevalent in Chinese church polity and governance. So there are all sorts of problems in Chinese churches. And in the West, we tend to hear a lot about how Christians during the Cultural Revolution suffered for the sake of Christ and how they resisted persecution. Well, those things did happen, but a lot of the time, Christians back in those days didn't know what they actually believed in. I have a friend who works at the Academia Sinica in Taiwan, which is the top research institution in Taiwan. He's a sociologist, and he's an evangelical, very faithful Christian. And he did a field study in China to find out what was going on during the Cultural Revolution. And he found out that the vast majority of Christians who came to Christ and remained faithful to Christ were motivated by miracles. There are all these miracles, which I believe were real. One of the most common reports was, rice never ran out despite not having come in to their households. Many people were starving back in those days. And they would find out that one of the neighbors in the village always has rice, and the food never runs out in the household, and they will wonder why, and they would ask, and they say it's because we believe in Jesus. So people turn to Jesus, and they get rice, they get fed. And I think that's the grace of God to preserve and propagate the faith. But then many people told the story of how they've never heard about the message of salvation from sin. One person actually said to my sociologist friend that he had been a Christian for 10 years, and a preacher was in town. The preacher preached about salvation from sin, the forgiveness of sin, and he was told that he was a sinner, and he was really angry hearing that. How can you call me a sinner? So that was the story. So most people were really just preserved by God's grace, and their faith was weak, their understanding was weak, and God knew their weakness. So when I tell the China story, I like to emphasize God's grace instead of how Christians are so heroic, suffering like martyrs. That did happen, but in the majority of the cases, it's God helping them through their days of weakness.
And despite the lack of theological vocabulary, perhaps,
right.
And the lack of ecclesiological sort of practices that are more by the Bible, you know, one of the things I say to my students is the greatest need that Asia needs is actually a better ecclesiology.
Yes.
Because of what you said.
Yes.
Whereas in the West, people expect plurality of leadership, accountability, checks and balances to power. I feel like in Asia, especially in Chinese context, and I came from a Chinese-Indonesian context as well, they want an authoritarian leader. Mm-hmm. They don't see that as a sign of weakness, but they see that as a sign of goodness, strength.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's interesting to me that when you say this, you know, you mentioned a couple of days ago when you first arrived and we had dinner, you said there's something about American evangelicalism that likes to sensationalize, perhaps mm-hmm. in mythological proportions, the suffering of people in the global world. You hear that with respect to Indonesia, about, you know, the largest Muslim country in the world. Is there Islamic persecution? Yes, but in very small pockets. And actually, the majority of Indonesia is very tolerant to, mm-hmm. to the Christian faith, actually.
But there's something really refreshing, actually, with what you just shared, because mm-hmm. it's so God-centered. I mean, the stories and narratives we hear about the persecution, and it's real. I mean, that's sort of what we hear. And I think it's just because it's the easiest narrative to tell, mm-hmm. because it's the most high profile. The details of what the underground church in China is enduring, I mean, that information is not readily available. So to hear it told from the perspective of the grace of God that's preserving, as opposed to the heroism of the Christian, yeah. again, there's something right. about that I find very comforting to remind ourselves that, you know, that the persecution is real, but persecution's everywhere. I mean, even in the West, even if we're not mm-hmm. aware of it, to some degree, it's there in very different shapes and forms. But the narrative about the church is always a narrative about God and what He is doing through yeah. Christ. And to be reminded of that, I actually find that very refreshing. Thank you for that.
Thank you. And perhaps something else I could share is nowadays many Christians with the financial means are running away from China because of all the persecution, and not just the persecution, but also the bad economy. They are running, and there's actually a Chinese word for that, run, which is a phonetic translation of run. Yeah, so they are running. They don't want to stay in China. Overall, I think the mood in China is one characterized by hopelessness, not just among Christians, but in society in general. People are hopeless about the economy. They're hopeless about the political future. There's just no hope. And I think the fact that so many Christians in big cities like Beijing and Shanghai are trying to run is very alarming, because I think Christians are called to be in the world to testify to the hope that this world doesn't have. And we are called to give the reason for the hope that we have in Jesus Christ, 1 Peter 3:15. And the fact that so many Christians in China, especially urban China, are looking for hope that is on earth and not in heaven, is very telling of the status quo of the so-called persecuted churches in China. Mm. Yeah.
So from a academic kind of point of view, you know, you mentioned wanting to put this, your kind of academic research to use in pastoral ministry. To what extent has that been possible? I mean, if a lot of the problems that you're dealing with are sort of ordinary faithfulness kinds of issues, ecclesiology issues, is Nietzsche all that helpful? What has been the usefulness of that list of philosophers that you had to your ministry in China?
Yeah, thanks for that question. It's really important. So in my Sunday preaching or Sunday school classes, I don't talk about Nietzsche or Kant or Hegel, right?
Not even Hegel.
No.
I would have thought that for sure.
Yeah. We talk about Marx sometimes.
that makes sense. Okay.
And
for listeners, Alex did write 3 small books for the PNR Great Thinker series on Kant, on Hegel, and on Barth.
Yeah, and I think that's helped me a lot. When I was writing those books, I actually didn't know the philosophers that well, so I had to do a lot of research and learning. I did study Barth for my PhD, but Kant and Hegel were just side thinkers helping me to make sense of Barth. So I had to really read a lot of secondary literature and primary sources on the philosophers. But studying modern philosophy, I think, has been really helpful to my ministry in that they give me something like a roadmap of how we got here from pre-modern times to our modern times. It helps me make sense of the things that are going on around us today in the world. For example, why is Putin waging war on Ukraine? And it's not just because NATO is expanding. It's not just that. It might have some things to do with that. But if you look at the propaganda in Russia, it's deeply religious. It's a mystical nationalism that is really convincing people to support Putin. Mm-hmm. And if you look at where that ideology comes from, it's from modern Germany. It's from modern thinkers like Hegel, as well as Nietzsche to an extent. And it's that same ideology that made Meiji Japan a empire that tried to expand itself to throughout Asia. One interesting fact about Meiji Japan is Emperor Meiji, when he declared when he declared Japan to be a modern secular state, it was written in the Meiji Constitution that all Japanese citizens had the freedom of belief. They could choose any religion to believe in. But less than 2 years after the Constitution was in effect, he issued an imperial edict which says that all Japanese citizens have to be Shinto practitioners. Mm. And Shinto was treated as something as supra-religious. So you could be a Catholic, you could be a Protestant, you could be a Buddhist, but at the same time, you also have to be a Shintoist, because Shinto is the Japanese geist or spirit. In Japanese, Yamato Damashi. And the emperor was declared to be an embodiment of the Japanese geist, so he was declared to be a Arahitogami, which means secular god or this worldly god, mm-hmm. in the form of a man. Yeah, or secular man god, yeah. or god man. It's the incarnation, it's the doctrine of the incarnation. And you look at where that ideology came from. It came from Germany. It came from modern German philosophy. The German jurist, 20th century German jurist, Karl Schmitt, had this comment in his book, Political Theology, that all theories of the modern state are immanentized or secularized versions of Christian theology.
Which is very Hegelian.
Very Hegelian, yes.
And so there's a direct line from mm-hmm. these Japanese and Russian ideologies mm-hmm. to Hegel.
Yeah.
This is fascinating. So how often, what are some other areas where what I would think of as just Western philosophy versus Eastern philosophy, mm-hmm. where are those other areas that those are kind of merging or informing one another?
I think it's this identity that is posited between the transcendent and the immanent, mm-hmm. Between God and the world. So Eastern philosophy really likes to think of heaven or God as immanent to this world. So we are all potentially divine, and we can become divine through various practices, moral or mythical and whatnot. And that kind of pantheism was what became really popular in Europe in the 19th century, mm-hmm. or probably from the 18th century onward. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you even see that traces of that already in Neoplatonism, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The idea that you can reach transcendence by way of ascetic right. discipline, right?
Right.
This is really interesting. So is what you're saying the primary goal of learning these modern texts is to understand where we come from? Is it also to understand them in such a way so that we can criticize them? Is there any positive mm-hmm. value, not just critical value?
Oh yeah, definitely. Modernity has given us a lot. And when we talk about modernity, we think about secularity, secularization, secularism. In Christian circles, this word is usually shunned, or it's a bad word, secularism. But if you just look at the definition, it basically means a separation of church and state, the separation of the sphere of religion from the political sphere and other spheres like education. And is it all that bad? As a neo-Calvinist, I don't think so, because we believe in sphere sovereignty, right? We don't want our political state to be the same as the church, or we don't want the church to run the White House, right? So I think secularism can take on different forms. It can take on a Christian form, which still presupposes that our order in society has to conform to a higher cosmic moral order, and that this order corresponds to the good nature of God. So as Christians in society, we have a cultural mandate. So we can think of it this way, whereas we can also have non-Christian forms of secularity. And that can take on actually two, two modes, two different modes of non-Christian secularity. One of them would be a disenchanted mode. Herman Bavinck would call it materialistic or naturalistic or mechanistic. So everything is just matter, and there's no order, there's no purpose to anything. That's disenchanted. And that has given rise to a kind of secularity, or a mode of secularity in the West, where people don't believe that morality or moral norms actually correspond or conform to any cosmic moral order. So male and female, for example, are just what we call them, and we can invent any gender. There's no higher cosmic order. There's another form of secularity that you see in Meiji Japan, in Nazi Germany, and in Communist China. You think China is an atheistic state, right? It's communist, it's atheist. You think Marxism is atheist. Well, it's called atheist because it doesn't believe in the God of the Judeo-Christian religion, as they would have it. But it's not absolutely atheist. It's actually pantheistic. Communism or Marxism is pantheistic because they believe that matter is not just matter. There's inherent meaning and purposiveness to matter. So Marxist materialism is called historical materialism. The Soviets called it dialectical materialism, which means matter is not just matter. Matter is inherently divine, and nature is inherently divine. So individual human beings might be finite, but human being as a species is infinite, and there's divine purpose in the human species, and that is realized through history. And the establishment of the communist state is the fulfillment or the consummation of divinity within humanity. So it's pantheism. It's dynamic pantheism. And you wonder why China, as an atheist state, uses four times the word 神圣 in its constitution. 神 means God or divine. 圣 means holy. So this word 神圣, or this term 神圣, divine and holy, is applied to the sovereignty of the Chinese state. It's applied to social ownership, things like that. So the state and communism is elevated to a divine status. So you wonder why people, so many people in China think of the state as something divine and inviolable and sacred.
I mean, this is a Hegelian sublation.
Yeah.
Of divine's transcendence and immanence, right?
Yeah.
And actually, that was Bavinck's argument, that actually, if you get rid of the classical theistic idea that the true and the good and the beautiful are located in this timeless God, this view of God as the simple and absolute being distinct from creation, you're actually going to end up substituting where you're going to place the good and the true and the beautiful. And usually it's going to be in humanity, not just in any humanity, but our humanity. Mm-hmm. And so he actually argues that atheism leads to nationalism and racism. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what you're saying here.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're observing things that seem to converge to what Bavinck was already observing in 1904.
I'm inspired by Bavinck. Yeah.
That's interesting. So when you're reading Bavinck, you're like, oh, okay, this is exactly what is going on.
Yeah, or? Yeah. Okay. He was so prophetic. When it gets to like particular points in his intellectual historiography, he might not know the kind of things we know today, but then he got the big picture right.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Can you give us maybe a little bit of how we should think then about the state and, you know, from your perspective? I mean, I know these are controversial sorts of ideas and there's not just one view out there, but what should the Christian relationship to the state be?
Yeah, that's a huge question, and I think I need to be really careful and thoughtful when I even try to answer it. I'm not ashamed to call myself a neo-Calvinist, but then even as a neo-Calvinist, some people call themselves libertarians. One of our friends who is a Dorvidian calls himself a Christian libertarian and anarchist, so he doesn't believe there should be any government and any state. So yeah, it doesn't really tell much when I say I'm a neo-Calvinist. Even if I call myself a Kuiperian on this issue, you can wonder if I'm a triumphalist Kuiperian or a real Kuiperian. Yeah, I would say that I'm a real Kuiperian. So I believe that Christians.
There's no bias at all in that distinction.
No, it's all objective and neutral.
That's I'm just kidding. They use, right? Triumphal versus real.
Yeah. I'm convinced that when God created the world, he created everything each according to its kind. And when he created human beings, in his triune image of unity and diversity. And so there are different kinds of relationships among human beings. God created Adam and Eve, and the way Adam should love Eve is different from the way Eve should love Adam. And the way I should love my wife is different from the way I should love my parents. If I love my dad the way I love Jasmine, my wife, that would be really messed up.
Yeah.
Yes,
agreed.
As a professor, I should love my students. But if I love my students the way I love my pets, that would be wrong. In human society, in human communities, there are different kinds of love, and there are different kinds of orders in different spheres of society. So there are different rules for different spheres of society. Of all these spheres, the religious sphere is most central because it's the sphere that connects us to God and knows God's helps us to know God's will for creation. So there's a unique place for the church in creation. But then that doesn't mean that the pastor should become the prime minister or the president at the same time. The pope should also become the king at the same time. Even in Roman Catholicism, there's a distinction between the temporal power and the eternal power. If we take into account the distinction
between the sphere of the church and the sphere of the state, then we will understand that they run by different rules. Yet at the same time, they're all within God's good creation, and God has called us all, not just Christians, but all creatures to the cultural mandate, at least all human creatures to the cultural mandate. And the problem is that if you don't believe in Jesus Christ after the fall, if you don't believe in Jesus Christ, by this I include people like Abraham and Rahab. They believed in Christ, right? Hebrews 11. If you don't believe in Christ, it's impossible for you to make sense of the covenant of works. It's impossible for you to make sense of the cultural mandate, much less to fulfill it. So a regenerate consciousness is necessary for us to fulfill the cultural mandate in different spheres of society. So Christians should by all means participate in education, in the government, but at the same time, we shouldn't impose the order of the church upon the government or upon schools, universities, so on and so forth.
I love what you said earlier about like that a Christian, or that a society, a state should seek, even in a secularistic mindset, conformity to a higher order, even a heavenly order of things. So how do you do that? And like what you're just saying, but not subsume it under the church, or how do you pursue that kind of higher heavenly order and it not be explicitly Christian? How do you maintain a kind of pluralism in society while looking to that kind of higher order?
I think when Christians participate in politics, they can be explicitly Christian. They can say we hold to the Christian worldview. They might even establish a Christian coalition, or like William Wilberforce did, or a Christian political party that runs on Christian values. But then they are not trying to impose the Christian faith on all citizens. They are just trying to run society by Christian values.
I can see a lot of the wisdom in what you're sharing and its application here in the West. Is this how you would disciple Christians in China? I mean, the governments are so different. Is this a similar type of thing that you would encourage Christians in China?
Well, in reality, we can't be explicitly Christian in what we do. But then we still want to adhere to Christian values and moral norms taught in the Bible. So, for example, I'm not a politician, but I teach at a secular university. But as a professor in a philosophy department, I fulfill my duties by adhering to the moral guidelines of Scripture. And when students see that, they recognize that I have different values than other professors in the university. And they would start to wonder why these Christian professors or certain professors act in certain ways. I have a Christian colleague who is very faithful and who also teaches at underground seminaries in China. And he and I, the way we act in our department is actually very different from the way other professors would act before the students. So they would come to us and they would start to wonder why, we don't pursue certain things like fame or money and things like that, and why we would be willing to sacrifice certain things in order to do what's right. And when they find out that we are Christian state, they start to ask about the reason for our hope. And that's when apologetics comes in. But it's always witness first. and then apologetics. And sometimes witness can't be too explicit in contexts like China or North Korea.
Amen. What do you want our listeners to know about anything?
Tell us something.
Something.
About anything in relation to China, your work, what's important for us to know as a lot of pastors and students or academics are listening. What would you say is the most important thing for us to know with respect to, let's say, China or your work?
Well, at the moment, what I'm really concerned about is Christian witness in this world. I mentioned 1 Peter 3:15, hope. I mean, hope was a topic that was really hot during the Cold War. Theologians like Jürgen Moltmann capitalized on hope, right? And I think it's something that's begun to come back because we are starting to lose hope again. Like during the Cold War, people had nothing to hope for, but the Cold War was over. People were hoping for a better world. People were hoping that, for example, China would become a democracy by first opening up its economy to the West. And this market economy would eventually bring in democracy, but that didn't happen. And people are starting to lose hope in China, lose hope in Russia, lose hope in the world. And I think it's a time that we start thinking about where our hope lies again. Back in the end of the last century, or back during the Cold War, we had to turn to theologians like Mohm and Pannenberg to make sense of hope. And I'm hoping that Reformed theologians, especially Neo-Calvinists, can develop a more biblical theology of hope for this world, and that Christians would actually stay true to the places that they are called to live in, and not just look for places that offer earthly hope. And I have in mind Christians in China who are running because there's no hope in China, and they think there's hope in America, so they come here. Well, I think, yeah, there's more earthly hope in America than in China, but that's not where our hope ultimately lies as Christians, right?
And that's ironic because in the cultural conversations today, people feel hopeless in America,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And what I like to say to students who feel that way, perhaps, or anyone who feels that way, is to zoom out a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. That's a great message for us all, Alex. Amen. Amen.
Thank you.
This has been a great discussion, Alex. We're super excited to have you here. We're very excited about the lecture that we're about to hear from you. I'm sure bits and pieces of that will get published as time moves forward. But thank you for having this discussion with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for those of you listening, we're glad you're here as well. And we will soon be returning to regular programming, be looking for a new series on the Lord's Prayer in the near future. And in the meantime, take care.
I have a bit of bonus footage for us. After we finish recording the podcast proper and prior to Alex giving his lecture at RTS Washington, we all sat down to dinner. We welcomed Mike Park to the table. He's our director of admissions and he teaches leadership discipleship for us. He's also been on the podcast before. And we had just a wonderful discussion with Alex. And at some point we all just agreed, hey, we need to push record. We need to get this on the record because it was such an encouragement to hear about ministry in China and also just how the Chinese church is praying for us and how we can be praying for them. And so we did just that. I pushed record, and after we all got over the awkwardness of knowing that we were now being recorded, we fell back into our really wonderful casual discussion of these things. And I wanted to include that here and hope that it blesses you as it blessed all of us. And so, without further ado, a little bit of bonus.
You just ruined my mojo, and I don't think I can do that again.
Well, as long as you're stopped, just do it casually, like you were doing, like it's like we're sitting over at dinner.
Yeah, go, go.
Yeah, just casual, casual.
What do we need to
don't
know?
Don't have the audience not casual. In mind.
Be yourself.
It is casual. Yeah,
it's not casual. Now it's recording. Now I feel on edge.
It's not recording. I turned it off. Just ask your question.
Okay. Just the whole question again?
Just ask, you know, what do we in the West need to know about?
Okay, you can offer something that really would be valuable here for us in the West is objectivity. So as a Christian pastor, as a Christian academic, what words of encouragement do you have for us here, for the church here in the West? What are we doing that we should keep doing? What are we doing that we should stop doing?
I don't think I have any wisdom or insight to offer on my own. But I can share that Christians in China actually pray for Christians in America because many of them think that American Christians are persecuted in a worse way, although subtler way, than Christians in China.
Wow.
And there's this vivid imagery that is often used on the pulpit in China, cooking frogs with warm water. So if you put a frog in hot boiling water, it jumps out. So the way to cook a frog is to put it in cold water or warm, lukewarm water, and then gradually turn up the heat, and then the frog doesn't know it's being cooked. And that's the way American Christians are being persecuted.
Is that right?
According to the Chinese narrative. And I think, because having grown up in North America myself, I think that's a very accurate picture and very telling imagery. Yeah, so.
My follow-up question is, you mentioned previously that Christians in China are feeling hopeless, and if they feel that America is even worse, should Americans be feeling hopeless? Give us some hope.
No. Well, I think that the hope, that the kind of hope they're talking about is economy, politics, that kind of hope. But when it comes to the church, when it comes to salvation, I think that they switch to a totally different frame of mind. So it's like they live in two different worlds. And it doesn't matter where you are as a Christian, you just go to church. But it's better to be a Christian in America than in China. Not because there's less persecution or more persecution against Christians, but because America's economy is better, there's more freedom in America. So that's the
and
kind
it's,
of
it's so subtle. I mean, it's so interesting because I think there's a sense in which the church here in the West feels like we are the church, you know, that it's our duty to evangelize the world, that we need to be the ones praying for the church in China, the church in the Middle East, and so forth. So to hear that there are the church in China is praying for us is such a humbling idea because. There is a sense in which I think you can say that the church in the West is persecuted, but it's not the same kind of persecution that the church in China is, and maybe the persecution is much more strategic, from a Satan standpoint. It's much more subtle, because he can't do what he does here in the West that he does in other places of the world, and Satan is smart, and he'd be wise enough to know that he can't do that. And just it's just a really sobering, very humbling, but very encouraging thought to realize that we first of all, we are not the church. We are not the highest expression of church ever in the history of the church. That there are flaws that we need to work on, and to be reminded that there are churches out there that are also praying for us. I don't know. I find that very encouraging, very deeply meaningful.
Mm. Yeah, but the other thing is that most Christian, at least underground church Christians or evangelical Christians in China, still think of Anglophone Christianity, that would include America and Britain, as the supreme expression of the church. So the most popular authors in China are still John Stott and Jed Packer, and Pulpit has become really popular these days.
Pulpit,
yeah. Tim Keller, yeah, those are the most popular pastors in China. So they still look up to churches in America and Britain, but I think America more so than Britain as the supreme expression of the church in our age. And also they think of America as the center of global missions, although they are also thinking that this center is beginning to shift to Asia. So there are many Korean missionaries going everywhere to Africa, to China. Now, when I first arrived in Shanghai, I started taking Taekwondo lessons, and I found out that most Taekwondo trainers and coaches in Shanghai are Christians. And that's because they learned Taekwondo from Korean masters, and Korean masters came to China as missionaries. So they think that the center of global missions is starting to shift to Asia. But then there's this strange nationalism among Christians in China that, you know, China is the greatest nation in Asia by population. And so Korea is just temporary. China is going to become the next center for global missions.
So am I hearing that there's kind of a paradox here? At the same time, they see America as this global Christian power, mm-hmm. and yet at the same time, they see themselves as a potential global power.
To replace America.
Yeah. So it's both a respect, but also seeing them as competition.
I recall Bob Inc. Here I am quoting, thinking of Bob Inc. Saying some, I think it was Bob Inc. This is my seminary days, so it was a while ago. Saying something about, you know, the central, brains of the church, the heart of the church, started in the Middle East. It shifted to Europe, from Europe to the UK, then across to the US, and that the trend is continuing. And so that, I think it was Bob Inc. or maybe it was Kuiper who suggested that in that trajectory, the future of the church is really going to be in the Southeast Asian nations. I think he thought more of Japan, where the church has obviously grown more within China and Korea. But that, it again, we mentioned how he's almost prophetic, and he may have been almost kind of quasi-prophetic in the same way and see mm-hmm. the movement of the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we can certainly discern this movement in history. But I think we also have to be careful, because that sometimes easily falls into the dispensationalist myth about how history develops.
Right.
There's this myth in China that when China becomes the greatest missionary nation in the world, we are going to be entrusted with the task of bringing the gospel back to Jerusalem, and then Jesus is going to come again. But that skips over the whole of the Middle East.
Right.
And I think that's very problematic.
Very, yeah. So what would you say are the primary differences between the marks of the church in China and the marks of the church in America, culturally speaking?
I think the marks of the church in China are very similar to the marks of the church in America, because China has, or Chinese churches, or Chinese Christians have been imitating American Christianity for the last three decades at least, or even more, since the Open and Reform program. It's mostly American Christianity that's informing Chinese Christianity. So talking about the marks of the church, one of the most popular books in China these days is the Nine Marks of the Church. So yeah, there you go.
Right down the street from us.
Right down, I was going to say, right down the street, right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
We don't need to close out because I'm just going to patch it in.
Great.
So we can just keep talking. And
yeah.
But surely there are some just cultural differences.
Chinese Christians in the last, I think, decade or so are really looking for a polity that is right for the churches. So they've turned to Presbyterianism. Most Baptists in China are starting to identify as Reformed Baptist. The nine marks, right? Reformed Baptist. Anglicanism.
Hmm.
And some are actually turning to Eastern Orthodoxy.
Hmm.
Many people like tradition, so they turn to Catholicism or High Anglicanism.
Hmm.
So these are trends in China. But I think overall, all these denominations, when they come to China, they get transformed by the local culture. So for example, in Chinese Presbyterian churches, you don't really have any checks and balances of powers. It's still paternalistic. Yeah. So still very Confucian, I think.
Hmm.
What do you mean by that, Confucian?
collectivistic, paternalistic, hierarchical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's interesting, even the immigrant church is similar. The Presbyterianism, which sort of, you know, will try to see the pastor as one of the multiplicity of elders,
mm-hmm.
but yet they still run in a hierarchy functionally. It is interesting that still mm-hmm. is here in the immigrant churches here.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, in the Korean American Presbyterian Church, which is a denomination, sister denomination to the PCA, they make distinctions of three offices. You have the pastor, the elder, and the deacon.
Mm.
So it's not the pastor being one of
the elders.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right. So that's probably the only significant distinction in the book of church order between the two denominations. I did have a question. I don't know if this is going to go in recording or not, but I did have a question about complementarianism in the church in China. I got a chance to visit Beijing a few times and spoke with a lot of pastors and Christians there, and they mentioned the whole princeling syndrome. When a son is born, then both sets of grandparents will move in to take care of him. And so that sort of, you know, alters the psyche of the man, if you will. And so they were saying that the frontline workers that are passionate about taking the gospel back to Jerusalem are 9 out of 10 times women. How is that playing out in the church in China today, especially with conservative denominations like Reformed Baptist and Presbyterianism growing?
I don't have the data. Actually, nobody does. So I'm only speaking from my own experience. Most Reformed Baptists and Presbyterians in China are against any form of women taking part in pastoral ministry. So let them teach children's Sunday school, but if someone teaches adult Sunday school as a woman, that's a no-no. But they can't explain the reason.
Hmm.
They can't give you any rationale behind that. They would just tell you that's biblical teaching. Women shouldn't preach. And I think that's problematic because before you can articulate the doctrine of justification, you shouldn't be so concerned about things like that, right? Mm. Get the fundamentals right first, and then start thinking about things like this. But the thing with most churches in China is that they want the superficial things to look reformed first. They don't want the reform spirit or the principles. They just want the outward appearance of being reformed.
That's so true.
Right, on-chain culture, right?
That's so true, yeah. And so in Jakarta, you find a lot of churches like that too, claiming to be reformed, but you're like, what does it mean to be confessional? They're like, it means I confess my sins or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But you also see a phenomenon of like female preachers, I feel like, in Chinese church communities, also in Chinese Indonesian communities. You and I both know that there's lots of female preaching, even in so-called reformed churches. How would you explain that phenomenon, culturally speaking?
I think it's because missionaries who came to this part of the world back in the 19th century and the early 20th century, many of them were women. So people were used to women preaching. Mm. And they didn't question that. And the reality was that on the mission field, you can't really pick your gender. You just need workers.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, sounds like church planting.
And that makes sense to me because, you know, if you're operating from the mindset that the Westerners have it right and they are the, you know, the highest expression of the local church, whatever brand they bring is going to be readily accepted even if you don't do as you've seen because, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. Now it's, you take ownership of it. And so there are cultural pressures that sort of shape now how things are going to be different. But you totally justify the white people doing that. Because they're
But I mean, even the very distinction of like principles and spirit versus outward, I don't think that's something that's operative in a lot of like Asian cultural mindsets.
Right.
That's 6 o'clock. Tommy, we're done.
Yeah, Tommy, we're good.
We're done. Because so it's six. It's alumni hour.
Oh,
alumni time.